From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. The Hispanic population in North Carolina has shot up since the early 1990s. Due largely to immigration in that time, Hispanics now make up about 9% of North Carolina's population. These immigrants, the majority are from Mexico, come to North Carolina and the U.S. because there are jobs here and more money than they can make at home. In the U.S., there is more material wealth, an impression to be gained in watching just a few hours of television here. The lifestyle is richer, at least monetarily. But is it necessarily healthier? Well, some researchers have identified what they call the Hispanic health paradox, that for many Hispanic immigrants, their health is better than others in the lower rungs of the American socioeconomic ladder. But after spending some time in the U.S., that advantage appears to shrink in some areas. In other words, being in the U.S. appears to decrease the health. And the question is, does this coincide with moving up the socioeconomic ladder? Or is it simply a matter of living here in the U.S.? With us to talk about the Hispanic health paradox this hour is Dr. Eliseo Perez Estable, who is a professor of medicine and chief of general internal medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you. Well,
and also with us is Andrea Bazan Manson, who is president of the Triangle Community Foundation, which looks into the affairs of the Hispanic community in North Carolina. She's based in Raleigh. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Well, first off, we are talking about the Hispanic community in the United States, and I think we have to define things here. You have looked into this very much, the Hispanic health paradox, Dr. Perez Estable. What exactly are we talking about when we talk about the Hispanic community for this paradox?
Well, the Hispanic or Latino community, as I prefer to use, is really quite heterogeneous in the U.S. Demographically, one can define it 60% or so are Mexican origin. About 15% to 20% are Puerto Rican, 5% Cuban, and the remainder are the so-called others. And the others are actually groups from Central America and all of South America and the Dominican Republic. What unifies Latinos in the U.S. tend to be first the Spanish language, because even among those who have been second and third generation, there is an identity with Spanish language. Second is a common cultural heritage that is rooted partly in Spain, partly in Catholic Church, partly in indigenous cultures, and actually partly brought together because they're here. And being in the U.S. makes them more similar than different. The health paradox is something that is unexplained by all the information we have. The traditional public health model says if you're poorer, your health is worse. And for almost every condition one looks at, that is true. Whether you see the United Kingdom, where class has been looked at and predictor of outcomes, or in the United States, where race substituted for class for many years, and when the world in the U.S. was simple of black and white, you could see blacks always did worse than whites for almost every level of income and every disease or health condition that one saw.
Because there would be that link of if you have money, you can get the care. And your lifestyle might be
it's
such.
It's really not about health care, but it's probably social, behavioral, environmental factors that explain most of the outcome. Yes, health care is part of it, not to say it doesn't matter. But there are other things that seem to go with having more education, more resources, better living conditions that led to better health. Mm-hmm. Latinos in the U.S. appear to, for many conditions, not all, but for many conditions, break that mold. And Asians do as well. So it's not, I don't think, a unique character of Latino populations.
No, you say it's unexplained, or do we have any senses of why that might be? Are folks who come from those groups, the Asians and Hispanic, is there a lifestyle that they bring or that they have come from that puts them in better stead?
There are some hypotheses. One is that the behavioral risk factors are potentially better. The one that actually matters the most, that is clearly less prevalent is cigarette smoking. But if you look at other things, it's actually not necessarily good. So there's more obesity, more physical inactivity. Nutritional habits are not necessarily better. They may be better in some ways, not better in others. Alcohol use is more prevalent among the men, especially in a binge pattern. So this is a mixed bag. There is a, unrelated to health, a theory of the healthy immigrant, that people who have the energy and ability to get up and move have inherently healthier. They don't come from the poorest sectors of society, and certainly the wealthy or upper middle class don't migrate either, unless there are social political reasons for that to happen. And so the people who migrate tend to somehow be selected for being stronger, healthier, have whatever. And this is healthy migrant theory, which is anthropologically and sociologically based, I think has a lot of explains a lot of what we see. If that's totally the case, then one should see a waning of this with time, of course, unless migrants keep coming, which has been what's happened. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're talking today about what's called the Hispanic Health Paradox. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. Eliseo Perez-Estable is a professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco and has looked into this. And with us as well is Andrea Bazan Manson, who is president of the Triangle Community Foundation and has long time been working about the affairs of Hispanics in North Carolina, aside from the work with Triangle Community Foundation. Andrea, just to go back a bit, does it track the same way in North Carolina from what Dr. Perez-Estable was talking about of the groups coming to North Carolina, or are they more homogenous?
No, we are also seeing here in North Carolina that the Latino population that has come here, first of all, has come very quickly. We are what's considered one of the fastest growing states in terms of the Latino population in the nation. This was something that we started visibly seeing in our region in the early 90s, which is when I moved here. And I think when the Census 2000 figures came out, you know, the census being the one that counts the population and many other issues of our nation, those numbers really kind of put us in the map, if you will. Everyone started talking about North Carolina and Latinos. I remember, you know, going to some meetings outside of the state and talking about the fact that I was working with the Hispanic population, and people were surprised to hear that we had Hispanics here. So we do have a very strong population here, large population. What we perhaps have, we are what's called the emerging Latino state. And that means that the population here has come over the past 10 to 12 years. So that is different from a place like California, for example, which has a more established communities as well as new communities also, but they have perhaps second, third generation Hispanics. We, of course, have people here that have been here for many, many years, but the core of the community is a newly arrived population.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eliseo Perez-Estable, when you're talking about the Hispanic health paradox, are you talking about people who may have been here for several generations? As is the case, there certainly is an established such a community in California, Florida, New York. Or is this phenomenon mainly among those newly arrived when you talk about the paradox?
Well, I would say what's newly arrived? I'm a migrant myself, yet I've grown up in the U.S. And my children, of course, are U.S. born. I think that we don't really have that kind of detailed data on a population basis. There are the studies that look at migration or generation or acculturation tend to be smaller studies, tend to be regional studies, state studies. They're not longitudinal studies. So when one looks at causes of death and disability in the United States, the leading causes of death are heart disease, cancer, and stroke. And for all three of these conditions, when you look at national statistics or state statistics in the states with enough large enough population, Latinos have lower rates of mortality for all three compared to white Caucasian Americans. And that's consistent. There's some debate about, well, there's some misclassification. There might be error in that. The rates are probably higher than they really are. And that's debatable for heart disease and stroke. I think that there are – it's not a done deal, so to speak. But clearly it's not worse. Another example that's very concrete is maternal health outcomes. Infant mortality for Mexican children in the U.S., and this has been true for over a decade, is statistically not significantly different than it is for whites. It's somewhat higher for Puerto Ricans and, of course, for African Americans. But for Mexican and Cuban children, it's not different. And Mexican in particular, when you see 40-50% of the women have not graduated from high school, when engagement in prenatal health care in the third trimester is quite common. So the standard predictors of outcomes are not working in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, the babies have a greater rate of survival than, say, other babies from other groups that were in similar places on the economic scale.
Correct.
Right. And we'll get back in a moment to explain, we'll look at possible rationales for that and reasons for that. We continue our conversation about the Hispanic health paradox with Eliseo Perez Estable and Andrea Bazan Manson. And we'll be taking your calls as well. Our number's 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. Despite fewer years of formal education and often difficult access to health care, recent Hispanic immigrants to the U.S. share something that doctors call the Hispanic health paradox. They are often healthier than others who are at a similar socioeconomic level in the U.S. But there is another paradox that after a while in the U.S., some of those health advantages decline. Can that be reversed? That's what we're talking about today. With us is Eliseo Perez Estable. He's a professor of medicine and chief of general internal medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, and he's been looking into this. Also, Andrea Bazan Manson is the president of the Triangle Community Foundation. They're in the studio today, and we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. So we're talking about the paradox. And you were mentioning, Eliseo, that women who have babies in the U.S., immigrants from Hispanic immigrants, the chances of survival for the babies are on a par with that of white American children, when we see other stats that show that African American babies have less of a survival rate than white children. What explains that? If given that the Hispanic immigrants may be at a similar economic level for African Americans,
right? The best thoughts about what might explain this have to do with social networking, community support, some undefined cultural component that keeps these families more intact, even though everything would indicate that they should be more isolated and have less social support. Acculturation, as we call when people become more acculturated to U.S. culture, second, third generation, do tend to have worse outcomes, but not in a dramatic way. There are indicators that if unchanged, these would continue, perhaps this gap would grow. Latina women, as they become more acculturated, tend to smoke more and tend to drink more. And those are two behaviors that specifically have an adverse influence on childbearing or on the health of a baby, both at birth and in the young age. So those would be concerns that would happen. But when you look at the macro statistics, the differences, aggregated or not, or disaggregated by some measure of acculturation, which tends to be birthplace and language, not anything more precise, do not show dramatic differences. Mm. I do also want to emphasize that Latinos are not all the same, that there are clear data that, let's say, Puerto Ricans do have worse outcomes in maternal health, maternal child health, compared to Mexican or other Latinos. And that may be another area that needs further investigation to figure out why that is.
Mm-hmm. And there's less of an immigrant issue there, too. Could it be that there's some what you call this acculturation? I mean, Puerto Rico, certainly an island there, that there
Puerto Ricans come and go as they wish because they're U.S. citizens. Yeah. And but there is, you know, mainland and island Puerto Ricans. They are distinguished. Yeah.
So. Andrea Bazan.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that a few years ago, we were interested here in North Carolina to see if the paradox that was being talked about in a place like California where this more established Latino community held true. So we actually looked at the birth outcomes of Latinas who were being born at UNC hospitals, which, you know, covers several counties. And we did find that the paradox was just as strong as in a place like California. And the reason why we looked at this is because we, at that point, did not have the social networks, perhaps, as established as in other places. So we didn't have tienda stores where people could go and buy typical food, and the communities were a lot more isolated. There were fewer opportunities for them to be with their own community. And so then we started looking at nutrition. And I know that that is also something that has been looked at in other places. And we found, too, that the traditional Mexican diet with the guacamole that has a high content of folic acid, with the tortillas that are made in the traditional way with calcium, those are things that are very healthy for a pregnant woman. So I think that the answer of why the paradox is something to for us to perhaps learn from is includes nutrition and diet. It includes this cultural belief. It includes some of the ways in which perhaps traditional Mexican women treat one another once they are pregnant. And we also wanted to look at this because we thought that it had some good policy implications. At that point, also working on the advocacy front, we wanted to highlight our community, the Latino community, not as a community that had bad health and it had a lot of needs, but also a community that had some things to teach other populations. And we think that that is one of the implications of the paradox when we look at it from a broader policy perspective as well.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Rhonda joins us from Raleigh. Hi there, Rhonda.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the program. Did you have a comment?
Thanks. I do. Thanks for taking my call. When you were talking about the behavioral indicators that may be different for Latino families, I was wondering if maybe they're, my stereotype is that they're more committed to family, maybe marriage, maybe religious type dispositions, and if those indicators are maybe some of the behavioral components that help and status to increase.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of studies that indicate that Latinos have a more collective orientation as opposed to individual orientation in their social behavior. We did this a number of years ago with regard to cigarette smoking and trying to develop cessation interventions for Latinos, and discovered that for the Latino smoker, it was actually as important to quit not just for their own health, but also for their children's health, their loved ones' health, and the health of others around them, something that has become quite incorporated in the U.S. now with the secondhand smoke emphasis. However, that was related to really this collective orientation, and other patterns have looked at this. So your stereotype is at least in part supported by data that implies that. And again, I don't want to overgeneralize. That doesn't mean that non-Latinos are not family-oriented. This is ridiculous. I mean, these are just trends that may actually only matter in certain circumstances around things like perhaps how poor women take care of their pregnancy and their newborn. With regards to religion, that's a variable. You're right that there's a higher proportion demographically of Latinos who are, quote, married, but there's also more single-parent households, particularly in the second and third generation. So it's kind of a mixed bag there. And there is a strong Catholic presence, but there's also a strong Christian non-Catholic presence among Latinos, immigrants in the U.S. And I think that those have factors that have not been as well studied. So what is, religion or religiosity or spirituality or just religious attendance? So people who go to church once a week, just to give you an example, on a survey, have better health. But is that because they go to church or is it just coincident to the fact that they go to church? And it is a predictor of doing, getting more screening and doing less less things that are not healthy for you.
Mm. This all falls under the heading, perhaps, of acculturation, because perhaps after a couple of generations, maybe the church going, you know, falls off somewhat. The diet as well, to mix religion and food here, if I could. you mentioned diet a moment ago, Andrea. And I wonder if there are changes in the diet that happen. You know, after a few years in the States, there's the television alone or advertising that one hears just constantly talking about fast food or the lifestyle that you, if you're an immigrant, you'll see other people doing and you want to adopt that. So you'll grab something that's just a lot of, you know, flour and fat.
Definitely.
That's a prepared food. And your diet changes and with it, perhaps your health?
Exactly. And actually, that there's many studies that are backing up exactly what you're saying, Melinda. And yes, all of us that grew up in other countries had a completely different diet, perhaps, than what we're having now. And
did you feel healthier before?
I was much younger when I lived in another country, and I had my mother cooking for me. Now it's up to me to cook for my children. But my children are growing up with a very different diet, and that is part of the acculturation piece for sure. And we do, you can see it very obviously in things like obesity rates that are becoming a huge concern for us here in the Triangle and in North Carolina for our Latino population, and that has to do, it's a concern nationally for all populations, all communities. But I know that in Latino population, you are seeing how quickly overweight rates are increasing among the children, especially, and the women and some of the men. And so I think that the diet is one of those first things that you kind of let go of when you move to another country. And so, you know, somebody asked me the other day, is you know, becoming acculturated bad for your health? You know, that's the big question. I think there's some traditional beliefs that some of us hold that are healthy, protective factors that make us stay perhaps a little bit healthier. But that is an issue, I think, again, going back to what Eliseo said, that I think we need to think about for our entire population, not just the Latino community, and hopefully kind of pulling out some of this traditional, you know, using more meats, more vegetables, more fruits is important for all of us to remember. And again, going back to the fact that the Latino population may have some things to teach other communities as we all try and become healthier.
I wonder if this is specific to the Latino population or just to every immigrant group that's come through the U.S. of being acculturated and changing the diet. And adopting the mainstream diet. And these days, the mainstream diet's pretty heavy in fat.
Right. It's probably been true for not just current immigrants, but 19th century immigrants as well. The difference now is that there's more universality to the culture and that the food, accessible food, is so inexpensive. It is the least healthy food tends to be the fast food that's relatively inexpensive. Obesity is a major health problem among Latinos, particularly the women and particularly the youth. So it is not something that goes away. And whether it is certainly exacerbated by the fast food diet in the U.S. as opposed to a more traditional diet. Linked to that is physical activity. It's one thing to be overweight or obese and physically fit. Another thing is to be physically unfit, and especially among the youth, but also true for adults. And I think those two are intimately linked and critical.
But many of those, at least recent immigrants to the U.S., documented, undocumented, would be doing physical labor, would they not? I mean, in fields, in poultry factories and construction sites. But
correct.
I guess they're not the only persons in their families.
Right. So. But how does one quantify that and say this is the kind of physical activity that we know leads to maintaining your weight, not having diabetes, and staying in a cardiovascular fit state? Adults tend to wane in the amount of physical labor they do in their work. And you bring up an excellent point. There's a lot of physical activity that goes on as part of work that doesn't get measured in a lot of health surveys when people are asked about leisure time physical activity as opposed to your work time. And if you're a domestic worker and you're cleaning house 8 hours a day, you're doing a certain amount of physical activity. How does that get quantified? I mean, that's a challenge. But that tends to go down with age, and the weight issues and inactivity really become much more of a problem after age 40. And the goal often is to keep from gaining weight, which is what naturally occurs. As one eats the same, And uses less energy.
And that goes across the board for everybody.
Correct.
Everybody. I speak from experience. Derek joins us from Raleigh. Hi, Derek.
Hey.
Hi, welcome.
I was curious if you guys had, like, basic cross-reference between, like, studies on sleep. Because I know from personal experience that the better you do at your job and the more you become integral part of a company or companies, you tend to get less sleep. And I've noticed from what I've heard from other people that in Mexico, they generally have an entirely different way about going through the workday. Like, they'll take longer at lunch and sit down. And I was wondering if that played a factor.
Okay. You know, that's a very interesting question. I guess you're referring to the siesta. And I will say that that's actually changed in Latin America today. I mean, you certainly see smaller towns where perhaps that tradition is still honored, and some of the elderly folks are still definitely kind of following that. But we are now seeing in Latin America a workday very similar to the one in the U.S., where you don't take a longer lunch break and you don't take a break in the middle of the day to sleep and rest, but actually you work through, and then you have come home at the end of the day. So that's what I would say. I was surprised, you know, going back to my country of origin, Argentina, recently, how few people did take naps. And this is just over the past, 5 to 10 years that it has really decreased. And it has to do with, you know, productivity and progress and perhaps also the American influence, I would say, and perhaps in Latin America, the way that we work here, that is also kind of being picked up in the countries in South America and Central America.
There is research that says that if you nap voluntarily during the day, you have better health. But it's hard to package that into an intervention. So napping involuntarily, so in other words, falling asleep, is not a sign of good health. It tends to be as you age and become cognitively impaired. So you're on to something by saying, is there something about sleep patterns that helps? I'm not aware of any systematic research that has tried to look at this in, for example, Spain or Latin America, where taking longer breaks or perhaps taking it easier was a reality. But I agree with Andrea that that has changed dramatically, especially in urban Latin America. It just doesn't happen. Professionals definitely don't take a break during their work day at the way it used to be 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Derek, if you're still there, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, okay, not napping.
I wish.
Would you be an advocate for naps then?
Well, I get about 6 to 5 hours of sleep a night, generally, and I work about 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a matter of, like, trying to spend time with family and friends and stuff like that. I decided that I could either have sleep or life, and I chose to have a life. And I've been interested in certain studies lately that have linked obesity in large portions to the amount of sleep we get at night, because they're starting to see that we actually burn calories in quite a significant amount in our sleep. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if that may have played a factor.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for your call.
No problem.
Thanks, Derek. Sweet dreams. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. That's 1-877-962-9862. We are talking about the Hispanic health paradox, and perhaps not paradoxically, it appears that we're holding up a mirror not just on the health of Hispanics, but on American lifestyle and health too. Part of this deal is that as immigrants come here and they become more part of the system, acculturated, if you will, they're going to adopt many of the same stats as other Americans.
Yes, but at the same time, I guess going back to what Derek was just asking the caller, I will highlight the fact that the core of the population, the Latino population that we have here in our region, has a different lifestyle than your more established communities. And going back to how many hours you work a day, you know, we see that the population we have here in the Triangle in the state is a very young population. These are workers. They have been recruited to come to the state to work in industries that need their labor. And so we are seeing a much younger population.
In their 20s?
In their 20s. I think the median six right now here is 25.2, mm-hmm. Which is much lower than everybody else. They have very long work hours, so that their work day is 10 to 12 hours, 6 days a week, lots of overtime, lots of need for the skills that they have, which are construction and some of the poultry industries and some other sectors that really depend on the Latino labor. And then we also know that the population here is one that doesn't have access to services, access to health care, access mm-hmm. to other things that you and I may have access to. So we have higher poverty rates, much less communities where they that have an opportunity to get education and improve their conditions. And so it is a very different population. So although acculturation is happening very quickly, it's happening quickly for the children, it's still an isolated population. And I think that's something for us to remember.
Okay. And we'll continue our conversation about the Hispanic health paradox and the state of health care for Hispanics and in general in the U.S. and North Carolina. We are talking with Andrea Bazan Manson of the Triangle Community Foundation and Eliseo Perez Estable from the University of California at San Francisco. And we welcome your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862 on the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're talking this hour about healthcare within the Hispanic community in the U.S. and in North Carolina. In the studio with us are Eliseo Perez Estable. He's a professor of medicine and the chief of general internal medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. Also with us, Andrea Bazan Manson, who is president of the Triangle Community Foundation. That's located in Raleigh. And we're welcoming your calls. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Nolia is with us now. Hello there.
Yes.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling from Raleigh, and I wanted to share that since I moved here 6 years ago, I'm originally from Mexico. I always been very fascinated with hearing about this paradox, and since I'm interested in having children in the near future, I was very especially touched and interested in getting all the data information on this. And it was pretty much just watching my surroundings, the information that was shared to me by my family, I have been coming up with my own conclusion of what's the answer for this paradox, and what we have been teaching the teachers at home are lately in the last 10 years are pretty much to stay away from food that contains preservatives, and I have been observing how a lot of Hispanic workers, women and men, stay close to their food roots and all that. My conclusion is pretty much that fresh food is what makes a difference on this benefit for kids and this paradox.
Do you think, Nolia, do you think that a lot of people are getting that message?
I think we got that message when we were growing up. And the culture, as they were saying earlier, and the importance of food and sharing with the family and giving your time when you are preparing a fresh meal as opposed to buying something that is a prepared meal already is part of what enriches the time spent on cooking something from scratch. Mm-hmm. That has been my own conclusion, and now that I recently married, I have been trying to do the same thing and try to cook things more from scratch, try not to touch cans, and do as much of fresh food and vegetables as possible. Mm-hmm. And, that's without taking into account any researches or any other data that your speakers have been sharing earlier, but that has been pretty much the main answer, the overall answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrea Bazan mentioned.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's now you know there's research backing up what you're already finding. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen here in the Triangle, for example, is the number of tienda stores. And these are stores that carry fresh produce and also products from Latin America or products that you need to cook from scratch. And we have those in, you know, some neighborhoods. There's two or three in a 3-4 block area. So a lot of those. And if you go there any time of the week, you will see people buying a lot of the kind of things that you're talking about. So really, this is part of the nutrition and the diet piece that we were discussing earlier.
Is it pricey to go to a tienda?
It's not pricey, actually. And you know, I'm a big believer in tiendas. I go all the time, especially to get meats and things. And these are more natural without preservatives. And again, these are another you know, demonstration of how what a great presence of the Latino community we do have in the Triangle region. These are stores that have just opened up over the past just 5 to 10 years. Before that, we hardly had any at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mirabel is in Greensboro. Hi there, Mirabel.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was asking if, do you know of any of an access to support education for immigrant children that don't have the support, and with the issue of the driver's licenses being expired and immigrants not being able to renew them or get licenses as easily, and their jobs are not going to be there as long as for many that need a license to get a job, or even not only the license, but just driving around without a license, you know, getting criminal records, and just if there's any chance in the future of having some type of amnesty for them, you know, that's going to be a problem if they have a criminal record. It's mm-hmm. going to be harder for them to become a citizen or a resident.
Well, that might be a whole other program on the issue of the driver's licenses in North Carolina.
But I think what, you know, you can, it's, you know, it's something that's on the minds of many people. And actually, you know, when we try to, I mean, there's two things I like to say about that question. One is that how important policy decisions are to our Latino population, because, yes, a lot of them are here, perhaps with the appropriate papers, without the proper documentation. But that's just an issue that is, you know, supposed to be decided at the federal level. It's not really being decided at the federal level. There are some things that are being done here at the state to address those, but it does, you know, call into attention the fact that policy issues, eligibility for healthcare services, access to things that we have for other populations is extremely important for our Latino community, and driver's license. I mean, the fact that transportation perhaps is not as readily available as in other communities. These are all things that will affect the health of someone, and so I think it's something that we need to bring into the equation as we talk about healthcare.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, about policy and health care, because you mentioned maybe access is not necessarily there. For that portion of the immigrant population that is undocumented, can they get access? Is that a hurdle when they go to a hospital in order to get access, or do hospitals take care of people?
No, it's certainly a hurdle, and it's something that any Latino that is in that situation thinks about constantly, in everything that they do. But I think, you know, our healthcare system here in North Carolina has done a tremendous job over the years. First of all, in learning about the population and increasing their bilingual capacity, our churches have done a good job at trying to teach the Latinos English so it could be a two-way street, and that's, you know, the way we like to see it. But it still continues to be a big barrier. There are some programs that certain people are eligible for and some other programs that are not. We have to remember that the children are mostly U.S. citizens. These are children that are being born here, so they are eligible to everything that you and I are eligible for. Some of the male workers, the ones that were brought in initially for these industries before their families came, they are the ones that are right now without much access to health care. So I worry about that sector of our population more.
I wonder, though, on that idea of holding up the mirror to the U.S. system, not all people who are American citizens necessarily have access to health care.
Of course.
Does it ultimately come, cultural issues may be there, certainly not having the language at least at the outset, not being able to speak English may be an issue. But ultimately, is it money?
It's money. It's money for every population. I think healthcare access, health insurance, health coverage is an issue that many people are concerned about. It's not just the Latino population. But, you know, we do have to think about the fact that we have brought the workers here. And so there's going to be injuries on the job, and there's going to be conditions that will have to somehow be taken care of. So I think we need to address this, obviously, proactively for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Eliseo.
The insurance coverage in the U.S., we all know 45 million U.S. persons have no health insurance. The disproportional burden is carried by Latinos across the country. 40% of Mexican Americans who are under the age of 65 or between 18 and 65 are uninsured. And the comparable rates for whites or African Americans are considerably lower. Much of this is employment-based insurance, and part of it is not being eligible for Medicaid if you're not a citizen or documented. And I think that this is a real problem.
Okay. Let's go to Ferris, who joins us from Raleigh. Hi, Ferris.
Hey. I wanted to mention that I did a research at UNC School of Public Health and NC State University at a free health clinic in downtown Raleigh. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed 121 Latino patients about their use of herbal medicine. And I found out that 97% of these patients continued their use of herbal medicine even after immigrating to the U.S. and settling down for over 5 years.
Is that something one gets at a tienda, or where does one go for the herbal medicine?
Well, you have
Andrea?
To know where to go for that.
Okay.
But yes, that is a very strong belief. And what we found is that many times they will go to a healthcare provider, but also do follow the traditional health beliefs. And there may be somebody in the neighborhood that is the person to go to for that. A lot of the tiendas do sell some of these herbal medicines. But again, to bring it back at the fact that it's not just a Latino issue. I mean, think about, you know, Whole Foods as a store and that whole herbal section, how popular and supposed to be the fastest growing area of the grocery industry is the Whole Foods piece of it. And so I think it's something that we're all trying to look at is going back to more natural ways of healing and taking care of our health.
But I would point out that the limited research that has been done on this, because it's understudied, would indicate that the Latinos do not use traditional medicine or herbal medicine, whatever one wants to call it, alternative medicine, in place of the biomedical model. In fact, they use it as complementary, and they select conditions that are perhaps more emotional, somatic, and appropriately seek those kinds of treatments. You still got to treat high blood pressure most of the time with medications, and there's really very little way of getting around that. So I think that's an important point there. It's not in place of, but really complementary to.
Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing, though, that might be the only access people have to medicine? And it's just the old ways they know? We're talking here about recent immigrants.
Well, but having access to ineffective interventions is not better than having no access at all. Mm-hmm. And yet you can treat, let's say, hypertension with medications that cost a penny a day. So it's really not only about cost in this case. The visit with a physician or a nurse practitioner is going to be more expensive than that.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, what would you advocate doing in North Carolina then?
To take care of Latino health issues? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much to be done still, although I do believe that we've done quite a lot already. And like I mentioned before, I think our public health system has really stepped up. We've got some great leadership both at the state level and at the local level. I know the health departments like the one in Durham, the one in Wake County have really gone beyond the call of duty in trying to understand the population and trying to hire people who are bilingual. I know that at UNC there's a great effort called Su Salud by the medical school there to teach medical students Spanish so that we can have more bilingual capacity. So I think that the language piece is a very important part of the equation. I think to look at the ways in which our population can become eligible for certain programs is important to think about as well. But I think I also like to talk about the fact that those of us in the Latino population also have a very strong role to play here. The Spanish language media has to be mentioned, there is a very influential network of newspapers and radio and TV that is very heavily used by the Latino population. And those are ways in which we can put positive messages out, some health education, health promotion. So I think we're well on our way. And again, this, you know, growth, this population came so quickly to North Carolina. I think we've done quite a lot already, but obviously a lot more to be done. And the other big piece of this, of course, is the policy piece, you know, immigration, comprehensive immigration reform, which is something we need. And these are very controversial topics at times. And so it's hard sometimes for the public health community to look at the population without getting involved in the in all of the political discussions that are going on at all levels in our nation.
Okay. We'll go to Judy in Asheboro. Hi, Judy.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. On the comments that I'm going to make, please understand that I am referring to illegal immigrants only, not to those who are here legally. The lady who made the comment that these folks are needed so desperately for jobs here, if these folks are needed so desperately to take American jobs, then why does the employer not provide health insurance for them? It is costing the taxpayer of this state and this nation thousands and millions of dollars for people who are taking advantage of a system that they have never paid one dime into. And I personally am opposed to the amnesty. I am not opposed. I am, if you are here legally, I applaud you and I applaud your efforts. But other than that, we are making a mistake on the national, state, and local level by allowing the Latino population to just take over our social services, our health departments, our hospitals. They go to the hospital, do not pay their bills, but that cost is passed on to those of us who do.
Okay,
Thank you.
Judy, thanks for your call. Well, what about her Judy's initial comment there? If indeed this very big wave of immigration has happened in the U.S., illegal immigration, because employers need people to do those jobs, Why wouldn't the employer pay for the health benefit?
Right, and I appreciate that question. That's a question that I get a lot, and I welcome every opportunity to talk about things like that because I think there is some misunderstanding about who came, how they came, and whose responsibility it is. First of all, I agree with you, Judy, that the employers have to be part of this equation, and they do have to provide health coverage for all their workers, whoever they are. You know, last night we heard about Walmart and what they're trying to do with their workers in health coverage, and I think that's a problem that we're seeing in many industries. So I agree that the employer has to be part of this solution.
Your point being on that even for many people who are U.S. citizens or in the U.S. legally who have jobs, their employers are not paying
providing
the
health insurance. Health insurance is very expensive, especially for a small employer. But I think we do need to figure out a way that they could afford it so that they provide some of the safety net and it doesn't fall upon government to pick up the pieces. There have been some studies, out in California that looked at how much undocumented workers put into the system. And one misunderstanding is sometimes that they do not pay taxes. Well, they do pay taxes, many types of taxes, even those that are completely undocumented. The IRS has a special number for such folks, and they actually pay their income tax at the end of the year, and they will never see any of that money back. The study in California that I'm referring to actually looked at how much the workers were putting into the system and how much it was costing the system, and it did not even out. We probably need to do more studies like that to look at what the North Carolina impact is.
And that may be another show, but for today we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you. Andrea Bazan Manson is president of the Triangle Community Foundation, which is located in Raleigh. And Eliseo Perez Estable is a professor of medicine and chief of general internal medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about our program, our email address is sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. We're a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Melinda Pencoff.